also applying it to the French mayor who said that distributing food at a migrant camp was illegal, and the Italian government that's saying NGOs can't go out into Libyan waters with search and rescue missions and all of that. I feel that that international vision is necessary to broadening the context of what's happening at just the U.S.-Mexico border, which you've just indicated is really not only about the U.S.-Mexico border. But I think an international vision and a bigger picture of migration worldwide would help here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have to have a broader vision of migration because, you know, migration has been happening for centuries. And given the increases in wealth disparities and the added crisis of climate change, we're going to be seeing more and more of it. And unfortunately, for a lot of countries, the response has been a militarized criminalization of migration that is creating a worse human rights crisis, but also creating economic incentives for people to try to continue to promote an agenda of dealing with it that increases countries' ability to incarcerate, to surveil, to police. And so I do think we have to understand this within the broader context and also understand it, again, within the framework of if we continue to have a system that responds to everything with punishment and criminalization, we're going to continue to confront this matter over and over again, and not just in migration. You know, we're seeing it with reproductive justice issues. We're seeing it with climate justice. We're seeing it with the legal justice system that this country also uses. And so I think we have to have a broader analysis that connects all of those dots.
Well, let me just bring you back finally, if I could, to the idea of abolishing ICE, which I think is fascinating. I've heard it said, you know, it's one of those things that is presented as, well, you can't get rid of a government agency, even if it's an agency that only recently came into existence. And part of what I hate, frankly, about corporate media is the way that they try to limit our political possibilities. So abolishing ICE is the kind of idea that the corporate media will tell us is laughable and impossible until we do it, and then they'll act like they invented it. And I just wonder, how do you encourage people to think around the ideas and the limitations that they're getting from news media, for example, and do the work outside of that and get beyond of that? I feel like work that occurs outside the media lens in some ways is free from some of the limitations that media try to present to people about what is possible and what can happen.
ICE as an agency was only created with the purpose of detaining and deporting people. It was, in fact, designed as an agency to terrorize immigrant communities. And so I think that it is very possible and realistic to get rid of it. There are a million other agencies that help in different parts of immigration laws in this country, and you don't need ICE to be able to do the other functions. So I think it's very possible to completely get rid of it, have a moratorium on deportations, defund ICE as an agency, restructure resources, and there doesn't have to be a replacement. I think we have to be very concerned with people who are advocating that it be readjusted and housed within the Department of Justice. I think we're seeing the worries of what can happen with the Department of Justice, who that is only aimed at incarcerating people. Housing our immigration policies there would only make that worse. So I actually think we have to be able to reimagine different structures. And I think what we're seeing is that also the American public has an appetite for it. We saw it with the most recent victory of different congressional representatives that are running in New York. But I think we've seen it with over 100 candidates coming out publicly to support the demand. We're able to do it as a policy and a platform that people will vote for.
That was Jacinta Gonzalez of Mi Gente speaking with Counterspin in the summer of 2018. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, this is Democracy Now!
The IPCC is clear in terms of our capacity still to be able to reach a strong 2030 goal. And that could happen if we focus our efforts and if we are able to create a process of synergy, collaboration, and global solidarity.
As negotiations continue here at the UN Climate Summit, we'll speak to Colombia's chief negotiator, Environment Minister Susana Mohammed. She just chaired the UN Biodiversity Conference in Cali. We'll talk about Colombia's pledge to phase out fossil fuels, efforts to decrease deforestation, and Colombia's coal embargo on Israel over the war on Gaza. Susana Mohammed is a Colombian of Palestinian descent. Then we'll look at the growing debate over nuclear power as Google, Amazon, and Microsoft invest in nuclear plants to power their artificial intelligence projects. But first, we'll speak to the daughter of Gubad Ibadolu, a prominent Azerbaijani activist and anti-corruption economist, now under house arrest.
They also tortured him in detention center. He did not have access to drinkable water. He did not access to proper food, medication, doctor visit. He was not allowed to be even visited by International Committee of Red Cross.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Baku, Azerbaijan, from the UN Climate Summit. In northern Gaza, at least 17 Palestinians were killed Monday when Israel's military bombed a home near the hospital in Beit Lahia. The dead were members of the family of Dr. Hani Badran, one of the few remaining medical workers at Kamal Adwan Hospital. Video shows hospital director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who lost his own son to an Israeli airstrike last month, comforting Dr. Badran after delivering the news. The hospital since come under fresh attacks by Israeli forces who shelled and fired on the building, including right outside Dr. Abu Safia's office. Dr. Abu Safia reports wounded patients are dying daily due to a severe lack of doctors and medical supplies. Elsewhere, an Israeli airstrike on a house in Gaza City Monday killed 7 Palestinians and wounded 10 others. Survivors said the strike came without warning.
We were at home having breakfast. I went out and suddenly heard the sound of a bombing. I returned back thinking it was another house that was hit. I saw the whole house was damaged. I started searching and discovered all of the murderers were kids. All of those who were at home were elderly, children, and infants. They were all women. Who else would be there? All of the men were at work. We were recovering them in pieces.
On Monday, the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process warned the UN Security Council that conditions in Gaza are, quote, among the worst we've seen during the entire war and are not set to improve, unquote. The warning came as Sri Lanka's UN ambassador delivered an annual report by the UN Special Committee on Palestinian Human Rights.
This year's report examines the mass civilian casualties and life-threatening conditions intentionally imposed on Palestinians in Gaza. Our findings conclude that Israel's methods of war align with the characteristics of genocide.
In Lebanon, at least 5 people were killed and 31 others wounded in an Israeli attack on a densely populated neighborhood in central Beirut. The airstrike tore through an apartment building near Lebanon's parliament and close to a UN building and several embassies. This is survivor Hussein Zahwa, whose family had fled earlier Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon.
At the time of the explosion, there was a lot of screaming. I mean, to the point that I could hear my little daughter, who was 7 years old, calling me, "Dad, Dad, Dad." Because of the smoke, they could not breathe. I don't know how I went up. The gate that I was opening was on fire. It was burning. I don't know how I opened it. I went up and pulled them from the rubble. Thank God it went well.
UNICEF warns 2 months of Israeli attacks on Lebanon have killed more than 200 children and injured over 1,100. UNICEF spokesperson James Elder warned nations not to remain silent in the face of what he called the, quote, normalization of horror in Lebanon. Meanwhile, a rocket fired by Hezbollah from Lebanon injured at least 6 Israelis and sparked a fire in Tel Aviv on Monday night. In diplomatic news, U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein said a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon is, quote, now within our grasp, unquote, after meeting with Lebanon's parliament and caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati in Beirut today. U.S. senators will vote Wednesday on whether the U.S. should halt $20 billion of arms sales to Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders introduced the joint resolutions of disapproval as the Biden administration has continued to violate U.S. laws that prohibit the transfer of weapons to governments committing human rights violations. 6 senators have publicly backed the resolutions thus far. Jeff Merkley, Brian Schatz, Elizabeth Warren, Peter Welch, Chris Van Hollen, and Bernie Sanders. Meanwhile, the rights group Al-Haq and Global Legal Action Network have taken the UK government to court for continuing to supply F-35 fighter jet parts and other weapons to Israel, despite saying it would suspend Israeli export licenses over international humanitarian law violations. The UK said it exempted F-35 parts from its arms suspension to avoid, quote, undermining U.S. confidence in the UK, unquote. In related news, activists in Canada have blockaded the entrances to Collins Aerospace in Oakville and Honeywell Aerospace in North Vancouver, both of which supply parts for F-35 jets used by Israel to kill Palestinians. Moscow says Ukraine fired 6 U.S.-supplied long-range missiles into Russia for the first time today. The Russian Ministry of Defense says Ukraine used the Army Tactical Missile System known as ATACMS in the strike on Russia's Bryansk region. This comes after President Biden gave Ukraine the green light to begin striking inside Russia and as Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a decree lowering the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. The revised nuclear doctrine states any attack on Russia by a nation backed by a nuclear power will be considered a joint attack on Russia. It also allows for Russia's use of nuclear weapons in response to aggression against allies, including Belarus. On Monday, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer also signaled Britain will supply long-range Storm Shadow cruise missiles to Ukraine for attacks on Russian soil. Separately, a Russian missile attack on Ukraine's Black Sea port city of Odessa Monday killed 10 people and wounded 44. 4 children are among the wounded in the attack, which struck a residential neighborhood. President-elect Trump has nominated Fox News personality Sean Duffy as Secretary of Transportation. In the 1990s, Duffy starred in MTV reality TV shows, including The Real World, Boston, and Road Rules. Duffy served five terms as a Republican Congress member representing Northern Wisconsin until 2019, when he resigned from Congress. In 2016, he authored the PROMESA Act, which created an unelected, federally appointed control board with sweeping powers to run Puerto Rico's economy. Duffy has a 2% lifetime score from the League of Conservation Voters. He's previously blamed the sun rather than human activity for global heating, and has promoted what he called alternative science, challenging the overwhelming scientific consensus on the climate crisis. Meanwhile, a lawyer representing two women who testified that Trump's nominee for Attorney General Matt Gaetz paid them for sex has revealed new details about their testimony to the House Ethics Committee. The lawyer, Joel Leppard, on Monday told CNN one of his clients was an eyewitness to Gaetz having sex with a minor.
She was invited to a party in July of 2017. She testified to the House that as she was walking out to the pool area, she turned to her right and she witnessed her client, her friend having sex with Representative Gaetz, and her friend at that time was 17.
Attorney Leppard has called on the House Ethics Committee to release its report on Gaetz, who resigned from Congress last week, even as President Trump tapped him to lead the Department of Justice. So far, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson has refused calls to release the report on Gaetz. Donald Trump confirmed Monday he plans to declare a national emergency and deploy the military to enact mass deportations when he returns to office. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit against Immigration and Customs Enforcement seeking more information on Trump's plans, including ICE's use of privately chartered flights. The ACLU's director warned of an unprecedented attack on immigrants, writing, quote, "As we ready litigation and create firewalls for freedom across blue states, we must also sound the alarm that what's on the horizon will change the very nature of American life for tens of millions of Americans," unquote. The FBI is investigating what appears to be a new campaign of abusive text messages, this time targeting Latinx and LGBTQ people. Some recipients receive messages telling them they were selected for deportation. Other messages said recipients should report to a re-education camp. This comes on the heels of a text message campaign targeting black people in the wake of Trump's election victory, in which recipients were told to report to plantations for slavery. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans are considering spending caps and new work requirements for recipients of Medicaid, SNAP, nutrition assistance, and other social programs. That's according to the Washington Post, which reports the changes would impact at least 70 million low-income people. The proposed cuts come after Trump promised to slash the corporate tax rate from 21% to 15%, an annual tax cut worth $48 billion to the 100 largest U.S. corporations. Here in Azerbaijan, the UN COP29 climate summit has entered its final stretch, with negotiators from nearly 200 nations still far apart on a new climate finance commitment. One major source of debate is a proposed UN-backed carbon market, which proponents say could help offset an extra 5 billion metric tons of carbon emissions annually. Opponents say carbon markets allow major polluters to greenwash their emissions while devastating the environment and frontline communities. This is Ariel Deranger, director of Indigenous Climate Action.
These carbon markets are literally putting our lands and territories up for land grabs, and to allow the sanctioning of multinational corporations to have a system to sort of simply buy themselves out of continuing to pollute.
A recent study in Nature Communications looked at the use of carbon credits in more than 2,000 projects. It found less than 16% of carbon credits issued constituted real emission reductions. After headlines, we'll have more on the COP29 UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, speaking with Colombia's Environment Minister, Susana Mohammed. A Hong Kong court has sentenced 45 pro-democracy activists to up to 10 years in prison for their involvement in an unofficial primary election in 2020. It was the largest trial yet under the Beijing-imposed national security law. Among those convicted were prominent activists Benny Tai and Joshua Wong. This is a pro-democracy activist, Chen Poying, whose husband, Leung Kwok Hong, received a sentence of nearly 7 years.
Actually, the situation is quite clear. All these people are peaceful. They have always only called for people to vote, which is the most peaceful and legal method. It's shocking that the court has given such harsh sentences.
And in New Zealand, 42,000 people gathered in front of the Parliament building in Wellington earlier today after taking part in a historic march to oppose a bill that would roll back indigenous Maori rights established in the Treaty of Waitangi, considered New Zealand's founding document. This is one of the protesters.
We just want to make sure that we're not giving away what was taken away from us, you know, what's left of what we have in our culture and in our people, you know.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. We begin today's show with more on the ongoing crackdown on human rights defenders here in Azerbaijan. Gubad Ibadoglu is a political economist and anti-corruption activist who's called for greater transparency in oil and gas sector revenues. He was violently detained in July of 2023 on charges Human Rights Watch describes as bogus. If convicted, he faces over 17 years in prison. He spoke to the BBC last week from house arrest.
Azerbaijan economy heavy relies of the oil and the gas sector. My academic and the policy research focus on the oil and the gas revenue and how the oil and the gas revenue manage in Azerbaijan, and I promote the transparency, anti-corruption, and accountability, not in the Azerbaijan level, in the national level. As you know, I am academic. I need to go to the university, but instead the university, I am going every week, twice to register, to report the police department. I am a law-abiding citizen of Azerbaijan. Unfortunately, we are living the lawless country. There is no any role of the court, and this is not legal process. It depends on the political decision.
Before his arrest, Gubad Ibadoglu was a senior visiting scholar at the London School of Economics and Rutgers University. He'd previously led anti-corruption nonprofit here in Baku called the Economic Research Center, which the government shut down in 2014. Since then, Ibadoglu had been living in exile until he returned last year to visit his family when he was detained. He spent the next 9 months in pre-trial detention and was moved to house arrest earlier this year because of his deteriorating health. To talk more about Gubad Ibadoglu, we're joined right now by his daughter, Jala Biramova, a human rights lawyer who focuses on LGBTQ rights. They've been advocating for his release, as well as the release of other political prisoners here in Azerbaijan. And they won the 2024 Magnitsky Prize in the category of Outstanding Young Human Rights Activist. They join us now from Johannesburg, South Africa. Jala, welcome to Democracy Now! I'm sorry under these conditions. Can you talk about why your father was imprisoned and now under house arrest?
Thank you a lot for having me here. And the main reason my dad, Dr. Gubat, was in prison is that because of his research on corruption and the oil and gas industry and how it affects environment and transparency. And the oil and gas industry, also quite Azerbaijani one, well known for money laundering and the corruption around the world. What my dad was doing, he was investigating money laundering while he was teaching at LHC. And what his investigations were showing as well is that Azerbaijan was not only money laundering, but also using the money to corrupt Western politicians, diplomats, but at the same time, not doing it alone, but doing it together with Russia and the Turkish government. What my dad was trying to do is to investigate them, but also he opened them a foundation in UK, and that foundation is supposed to serve as a scholarship for Azerbaijani students. And my dad wanted to get that laundered money to that foundation so that the Azerbaijani students can actually come and study in Western countries, learn more about human rights and democracy, and then try to, young people try to change the country in a better and a meaningful way. And what that's what basically was the main reason that Azerbaijani government decided to detain him in a very horrible fashion, as they basically physically assaulted both my parents.
Can you talk about the day that your dad was arrested?
On the day when my dad was arrested, I was actually working on my diploma thesis for my master's degree. We actually talked, and he told me that he's going to come and read that and let me know what he thinks about it. And then he went together with my mom to do a shopping. My dad came to see my grandma, who is a disabled person, so they were doing shopping for her. And on the way, while driving, the six police cars, actually they were civil cars, so they didn't have even like police emblem on them, physically they crashed their car, and then 20 men in black came and physically assaulted my parents. My mom was extremely terrified. She actually thought that this is some kind of like a trafficking or mafia, like organ mafia or sex mafia. So she was actually screaming, saying that like, I'm too old for that. Like my husband's organs are not working, because they didn't have any police symbol and they didn't even introduce themselves. So they basically attacked on my family, my parents. As a result, my mom lost 30% of her nerve function on her right side of brain, so she has been having difficulties just to balance herself. And my dad was kept 9 months under the isolation center without no access to drinkable water, proper food or medication, and then transferred to the house arrest.
And talk more about what happened to your mother.
So while my mom was detained, she was actually kept there to pressure my dad. And the reason that they were trying to do is they were threatening my dad that they're going to rape her and they're going to physically assault her. So they were kept in different cars, but then later on in different rooms in organized crime department since their detention. So they couldn't even meet. My mom has to stay in Azerbaijan for 2 months, and she was being followed all the time. We couldn't get her out because she had a travel ban. But me and my brothers, we have been doing this advocacy around the world to rescue our parents. And as a result of European Parliament resolution on September 2023, we managed to move my mom to Sweden together with me. So she's staying with me right now. And we had to hospitalize her a couple of times in Lund Hospital. However, it took us 2 months to get her out. And she was, in a sense, our priority to rescue, because she was extremely worried about her, as she has never done anything political. And the reason that they did this, the way that they physically assaulted my parents and brutally attacked them, is because they wanted to show everybody and create also a chilling effect. They wanted to show that, see if the Aliyev regime can detain a LAC professor and actually can physically assault his wife, then he can do it to anybody. Because never in our history anybody's wife has been detained or has been physically assaulted in this way. So it's the first time for us, for our society as well.
We're, I guess you could say, in a kind of silo here at the UN Climate Summit, Jala. And there's very little awareness here of what's going on outside. If you can talk about what has happened over the last year in the lead up to this COP summit, and your father, an anti-corruption economist, is not unrelated to this summit, because he particularly is calling for transparency around oil and gas transactions. And if you can talk about what those oil and gas transactions mean for the president, Aliyev, and the people in his government.
now. We basically have more than 300 political prisoners. When my dad was detained, before his detention, we had 98 political prisoners. And after him, in less than 6 months, they detained more than 200 people. So what we call it is a start of an unprecedented crackdown. And what we understand that is quite related to COP29. In previous events that Azerbaijan hosted, like Eurovision or some kind of like European Games, we had a lot of activism has been done by civil society. People will do a lot of activism. People will try to inform everybody what's going on in Azerbaijan. So basically, in a sense, the regime, learning from this, decided to clean up all the streets from activists from Azerbaijan or from all the civil society. Even there was two separate persons who protested in blue and green zone. They were also physically assaulted and was kicked out from both places, and they were both Azerbaijanis who has been protesting for animal rights, but also the labor rights of the people who has been working for the COP29 venue, and they have not been paid enough. As for the oil and gas, what my dad's research shows is that the 1.3% of the whole energy balance of Azerbaijan comes from renewable energy. So 70% and 28% respectively comes from oil and gas energy. So Azerbaijan is not even actually investing on renewable energy. At the same time, the more than 50% of the Azerbaijani budget revenues actually comes from oil and gas. So it's very important because after the invasion of Ukraine, right now Europe is trying to rely on Azerbaijan and buying oil and gas from Azerbaijan. But also my dad's research shows that the oil and gas that Azerbaijan pumps to Europe is not really coming from Azerbaijan, because the Azerbaijani oil and gas basic extraction is getting more and more difficult, and we don't really have enough to supply it to Europe. What Azerbaijan right now is doing, also buying it from Russia. So considering that our economy is completely relying on oil and gas sales, and the COP29 is a great place to have a lot of oil and gas lobbyists, it's actually a great chance for Azerbaijani government to have more oil and gas contracts, whether this comes from Russia or not, and then to enrich the regime itself.
Anjala Bayramova, you are a human rights lawyer. You have a good deal of experience understanding what's going on here. If you could explain who the Azerbaijani president is, Ilham Aliyev. He's been in power for 20 years following his father. His regime routinely targeting climate activists, human rights activists, and journalists, jailing them.
I can actually explain it from my own experience in Azerbaijan whenever I was living there. I was tortured twice in Baku and also in Lankaran, in a different city as well. So I'm a human rights lawyer, but I was also working as an activist. I have been observing the elections, writing the cases to European Court of Human Rights. And what happened is that as a result of all these tortures, I cannot sleep without a neck pillow, as they injured my neck discs. They also crushed my ribs and my kneecap, so which means that I am unable to wear like a normal bra and all those things, because I still have injuries that I have in my body, and I'm also diagnosed with PTSD. So this is like one example from me, but that's not it. Azerbaijan government is not only staying there and only like targeting us physically, detaining us in detention center. No, they're also trying to target us psychologically. So for example, they spread our personal photos. My personal photos have been spreaded on the internet, and those photos was from like my first Halloween in Sweden. So they're spreading this kind of photos as trying to like kind of like picture us in a bad light, saying that, oh, we're pro-Western, we're pro-European, so we are like, I don't know, celebrating Halloween and all these things. I also have pictures, and also my dad's with LGBT flags, which they also spread on internet. Azerbaijani government also sex tape the activists. They put hidden cameras to their rooms, to their bathrooms. They even sometimes send spies to have a relationship with especially women activists and sex tape it and put it on internet. So it sounds like a movie, but it's in a real life situation in Azerbaijan. At the same time, while talking about the regime, I think it's quite clear when looking at the Azerbaijan regime, it's quite clear to see that before Ilham Aliyev, it was his father who was also president of Azerbaijan during Soviet Union and a KGB general. And Ilham Aliyev, as it seems, getting his son to get ready to succeed himself. And his wife is a vice president of Azerbaijan. So it's more like a monarchy. It's a family affair in a sense. And they own everything. Like they own all the insurance companies. They own all the banks, properties, and everything is It's not a state-owned, it's a family oligarch-owned in Azerbaijan.
Zhala Bayramova, we want to thank you for being with us. Azerbaijani human rights lawyer, LGBTQ activist, and daughter of the political prisoner Gubad Ibadolu, a prominent anti-corruption economist and well-known professor, imprisoned and now under house arrest. Zhala has been advocating for his release, as well as the release of other political prisoners in Azerbaijan. Coming up next, we look at the growing debate over nuclear power as Google, Amazon, Microsoft invest in nuclear plants to power their artificial intelligence projects. Stay with us. Azerbaijani guitarist Rahman Mehmedli. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting here at the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. We turn now to look at the controversial push here at the UN Climate Summit to expand nuclear power production across the globe. Supporters of nuclear energy view it as a carbon-free energy source that's needed to combat the climate crisis. But critics warn nuclear power is too expensive and risky. Last year at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai, more than two dozen countries, including the United States, pledged to triple nuclear energy capacity. In a statement, the country said expanding nuclear energy is needed for, quote, achieving global net zero greenhouse gas emissions, carbon neutrality by or around mid-century, and in keeping 1.5 degrees Celsius limit on temperature rise. Six more countries joined the pledge last week. The Biden administration recently unveiled a plan to create an additional 200 gigawatts of nuclear energy capacity by mid-century. The incoming Trump administration is expected to continue the push to expand nuclear energy. Trump's pick for energy secretary, the fracking magnate, CEO Chris Wright, sits on the board of the nuclear power startup Oklo. Meanwhile, private tech companies are also investing in nuclear energy. Google's announced plans to build seven small nuclear reactors in the U.S. to help power the company's data centers and artificial intelligence systems. Microsoft has said it would fund the reopening of the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, the site of the worst nuclear disaster in U.S. history. And Amazon's cloud computing subsidiary has signed a deal with Dominion Energy to develop small nuclear reactors. We're joined right now by three guests. Alex de Vries, we're going to go to first. He's joining us from Amsterdam, a PhD candidate who studies the sustainability of emerging technologies at the VU Amsterdam University. He's the founder of Digiconomist, a research company dedicated to exposing the unintended consequences of artificial intelligence and cryptocurrencies. Alex, we're going to begin with you. Can you explain why there is such an enormous need for energy when it comes to artificial intelligence, AI data centers?
Yeah, of course. Well, the thing with generative AI and, well, huge applications like ChatGPT is that they're really using massive models in the background. And one typical dynamic is that the bigger you make those models, the better they perform, which is what everyone wants. But the downside of that is that bigger models also means more computational resources are required and thus energy in the end. When we had multi-million parameter models just a few years ago, now you're talking about models with billions or even trillions of parameters, and they just keep growing because everyone wants to offer the best user experience, but that costs a lot of resources.
So talk about, I mean, I don't know even how much people understand. I mean, in 2016, you found one Bitcoin transaction consumes as much energy as the average American household does in a day. Why does AI, why do cryptocurrencies, we talked about Amazon, we talked about Google, I mean, also Elon Musk with cryptocurrencies, with Bitcoin, why do they require so much electricity?
Yeah, they actually both contain economic incentives to keep spending more on energy. In the case of cryptocurrency mining, there is a reward available for those who participate in the mining process. And ultimately, everyone is incentivized to just, you know, keep putting in more computational power as long as it's profitable to do so. So the more money is available as a reward, which has been growing over the past few years as the Bitcoin price kept going up in value, the more people put in energy-hungry equipment to participate in that process. And with AI, it has very similar incentives in the sense that everyone wants to have the biggest, best, and most energy-hungry model simply because the biggest models offer the best user experience. And that in turn will give you the biggest market share and thus the highest revenues. So both of these technologies contain different but still economic incentives to keep using more resources to make these applications run.
So why is Bitcoin responsible for more than 95% of the carbon footprint of all cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, that's because Bitcoin uses the very specific mining process where in order to create a new block for the underlying blockchain, a new block of transactions, everyone in the Bitcoin network has to participate in what I like to describe as a massive game of guess the number, whereas the whole network is making an insane amount of calculations every second of the day, 600 quintillion attempts. That's like 600 with 18 zeros every second of the day, nonstop. One participant guesses correctly every 10 minutes and then gets to create the next block for the blockchain and they get a reward for that. These miners are earning up to or more than $10 billion a year from this process. But of course, they are also spending a huge amount of money on the energy to participate in this process. And nowadays, actually more than entire countries like Sweden and Argentina just for mining Bitcoin. But other cryptocurrencies, they use other types of algorithms, so those algorithms are not dependent on computational effort. This is why Bitcoin is kind of the only big cryptocurrency left standing today, which still uses the extremely energy-intensive mining.
So I wanted to ask you about the organizations and the people who are pushing for nuclear energy to fulfill the demands of AI and cryptocurrency. If you can talk about some of these companies. Well, we know Elon Musk, for example, is pro-nuclear.
Yes, of course. Well, there's actually two avenues here. First of all, what we see is that a lot of these tech companies are looking at existing nuclear energy sources as a way to power their AI operations today. One obvious advantage of nuclear power is that it's zero carbon energy. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to get this power from nuclear reactors that have previously been shut down. They're trying to revive these nuclear reactors. And this actually carries a very interesting safety dimension, because if you look at what goes on is that how these nuclear reactors, they get shut down at a certain point in time. They start to decay because the moment they shut down, they no longer have to meet safety regulations. And now these big tech companies show up and try to revive these facilities, which are already outdated and haven't been safe for quite some time, just to power their current AI operations because they want to have zero carbon energy. It carries a lot of safety risks. And then the other avenue is going forward, we also see a lot of talk about expanding the existing nuclear power supply to fuel future AI energy demand. But then the thing is, there's actually quite a bit of a mismatch between the needs of the tech companies today and, the ability to deliver that power to them. Because if you are building out new nuclear infrastructure, those are long-term projects that can take up to a decade to complete. Well, we're in the middle of an AI hype today, and no one is guaranteeing that there will still be this much demand for AI 10 years from now when your nuclear reactor is finished.
We're speaking to you in Amsterdam. The Netherlands had decided to phase out nuclear power, but then reversed its decision. There are two new nuclear plants being built there where you are.
You can see that nuclear power is indeed experiencing a bit of a revival. I guess everyone is realizing that this type of power is zero carbon, and that's what we need if we're going to go green. It's not as safe as wind or solar power, but then again, nuclear reactors nowadays, with the latest technological standards, are still very safe. But it's just that constructing them is relatively expensive compared to expanding the wind and solar power supply. So whether this is the best investment still remains a question.
Overnight here at COP29, the U.S. and U.K. signed new agreements for civil nuclear collaboration and said Australia was expected to sign, but Australia's acting prime minister confirmed today the country will not sign.
I can confirm that the Australian government will not be signing that agreement. For Australia, pursuing a path of nuclear energy would represent pursuing the single most expensive electricity option on the planet. For Australia, pursuing a path of nuclear energy would be pursuing a path which would see $1,200 added to the household energy bills of each household in this country. For Australia, pursuing nuclear energy would be pursuing a path which wouldn't see any new electricity into our grid in 20 years. For Australia, pursuing a path of nuclear energy would be pursuing a path which would only see, at best, 4% contributed to the electricity grid 2 decades from now.
Well, for more, we're joined here in Baku at the COP29 Climate Summit by Tim Judson, Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, part of the Don't Nuke the Climate Coalition, and Leona Morgan, a Diné Community Navajo organizer with Don't Nuke the Planet and Hall No. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! As you listen to this conversation, Tim, overall, we can hear everywhere here. I mean, the environmental movement is divided on nuclear power. And with this push on AI, on cryptocurrencies, I mean, you need nuclear power plants to fund one data center. It's absolutely astounding. The reopening of Three Mile Island. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing you got to understand about this recent wave of announcements about deals between nuclear power companies and data center companies and tech companies is that none of this involves buying power today. these are all deals to buy, to potentially buy nuclear power years down the road, you know, when some of these plants might exist. But the reality is that the tech industry is building data centers and operating data centers today, which are consuming huge amounts of power. And that's largely being powered, you know, by just what's on the grid, which is largely fossil fuel energy. In fact, in some of the places, a lot of the states in the country where this is happening, you're seeing things happen like they're extending the operation of coal plants or restarting coal plants or increasing the generation from gas plants and coal plants in order to power these data centers that are operating now. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is that the tech industry, especially under the, you know, under the Biden administration, is under some pressure to show that they're actually, you know, being pro-climate. But they don't want to wait to build data centers until they can build nuclear power plants. They're doing that now. And so it really seems more like what's going on here is sort of an elaborate greenwashing scheme.
So you can't help but notice that you have, you know, President-elect Trump's partner-in-chief here, Elon Musk, in charge with Vivek Ramaswamy of DOGE, that's the Department of Government Efficiency. Clearly, the way that we're going to be cutting billions out of the U.S. government budget is to deregulate. This at a time when they're pushing to build nuclear power plants. Talk about the deregulation of nuclear power.
Sure. Well, there's actually been a tremendous amount of pressure over the last several years, orchestrated by the nuclear industry through Congress, to pass various bills and pieces of legislation that are already rolling back nuclear safety regulation at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so the NRC over the last couple of years has actually been rewriting its regulations on how they license and permit the construction of nuclear power plants to make it, you know, streamlined, you know, more efficient, what they say, more predictable. But this is really just keeping the public out of the process and creating a set of regulations that there's no transparency to whatsoever.
Leona Morgan, I saw you the other day here in the hallways of the UN Climate Summit. You both were a part of an anti-nuclear action. I've also interviewed you about what's going on in the Southwest United States. You're Diné Navajo. Talk about the experience of the uranium cycle, uranium needed to fuel these nuclear power plants, and what happens on reservations and areas where indigenous people live here.
Sure, thank you. So the first thing I want to say is that nuclear is not carbon-free. Nuclear is not carbon neutral. Nuclear, it requires fossil fuels in order to extract the uranium, mill it, process it. All of the steps before the nuclear power plant require some type of energy. And so it is not fueled by renewables or nuclear. It's fueled by fossil fuels. And they just simply don't count the carbon footprint before the nuclear power plant or after the nuclear power plant. So in the Southwest, we're dealing with thousands of abandoned uranium mines. We're dealing with a conventional uranium mill that's taking waste from as far away as Japan and Estonia because there are not enough properly licensed waste facilities. And the same with the high-level radioactive waste after the power plant. There are two proposals in the United States to store it in New Mexico and Texas, and we fought that and we won. However, the industry is taking that to the Supreme Court. So we don't know what will happen. Maybe in June we'll find out. Hopefully our victory stands. But again, the nuclear industry is inherently racist. All of these activities, they depend on uranium, which comes mostly from indigenous lands, not just in the United States, but even as we're talking, you can think about other countries, Australia. Our Don't Nuke the Climate Coalition includes several folks from all over the world. And I also want to highlight what's going on in Africa. There's only one nuclear power plant in Africa, and Coburg is also slated to be restarted because of this push for a so-called carbon-free energy future. And so I just want to make it clear that it's not carbon-free, and it depends on the resources from our communities resulting in various health lots of health effects. So we haven't even begun to study all of the health effects, especially the genetic future. We know that it causes besides cancers, autoimmune disease, kidney disease, things like that, also reproductive issues. And so we really need to do more studies on the impacts from drinking contaminated water, breathing contaminated air, and eating contaminated food.
Leona Morgan, talk more about what's happened in Native America.
Well, going back to the beginning of colonization, I mean, I like to start with the doctrine of discovery, but from the 1872 mining law, which was created essentially to steal our land, we're still dealing with thousands of abandoned uranium mines, and there is absolutely no funding to clean these sites up. The United States, our taxpayer dollars are going to fuel not just this so-called nuclear renaissance or this nuclear revival, but also nuclear weapons. And so a lot of these so-called small modular reactors, they say they're going to power our communities, but a lot of it is going to be used for nuclear weapons. And so with that, we're dealing with, on Navajo Nation, where I come from, and most of the United States, we're downwind from over 900 nuclear tests from the Nevada site. So we're hit doubly with the nuclear weapons impact and then the nuclear power impact, because both of them require uranium. And so anybody living near abandoned uranium mines or anywhere there was uranium in the past are going to be threatened with new threats of new mining, new milling, new processing, and all the things that come with it, including the cancers, the contamination, and an unknown reproductive
future. Talk more about the uranium mines and what has happened to them.
So the uranium mines, especially in the Southwest, I'm going to focus on Navajo Nation. This is one place in the U.S. where they're kind of doing cleanup. Again, there's no funding for cleanup. We just lost what is called the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. And so the United States, since the 90s until just earlier this year, the United States provided some funding for compensation for people who worked in mines, only people who worked after 1971. And the eligibility is quite sparse. And so even RECA, people like Navajo miners claim that it is also racist, that they have not received the same amount of compensation as, let's say, non-Native or white miners. So what's happening in the country is there's no funding to clean up the abandoned uranium mines. And on Navajo, where there is some funding, not because the government is giving the funding, because the government is looking for responsible parties to sue. And if they're lucky enough to get some money out of those companies, then they can do what they consider cleanup. Cleanup is never done to community standards. So there are over 500 abandoned uranium mines on Navajo alone, some say up to 2,000. And if they're marked off or have a fence, that's great, because then people will know this is a contaminated place and not to build their houses there, not to plant food, not to play or work or pray in those areas. So a lot of these places are left unmarked with radioactive dust blowing around and getting into the water and our food sources.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. I also want to ask Alex DeVries more, because people may be very surprised by this whole push for small nuclear power plants to fund these AI mining, these AI data centers around the world. Leona Morgan is with us, DNA organizer with Don't Nuke the Planet, and Tim Judson, executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Center, also with Don't Nuke the Planet. Stay with us.
You gotta do.
A Good Time, Pushed, a new song by Kim Deal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I am Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan. We are still joined by our three guests, Leona Morgan, DNA organizer with Don't Nuke the Climate. Also, Tim Judson, executive director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And joining us from Amsterdam is Alex de Vries, founder of Digeconomist. I want to get to Alex in 1 minute, but I want to talk about alternatives and where you see, especially at this climate summit. Tim, let's begin with you. The whole issue of renewables and the we know how the government has funded the nuclear power industry for years. That it was dying, for example, in the United States because they couldn't afford the insurance alone and the threat of a meltdown, as we've seen from Chernobyl to Three Mile Island. But now there's a resurgence. Could you imagine if that money went into renewables?
I mean, it would be huge if it went into renewables. I mean, but the thing is that it's actually not necessary for all that money to go in, all that public money to go into renewables, because renewables are already affordable as it is, you know, just to be built if they, you know, if people were given the, you know, were given the access to them. But the nuclear industry is pound for pound the most subsidized energy industry in the, you know, in history. And the fact that they're pumping more and more energy, more and more money into it as this industry is basically on the verge of decline, is really one of the most false solutions that we're talking about in the context of the climate talks. You know, if nuclear, you know, had to stand on its own 2 feet, you know, it would phase out within a decade. But what we're seeing is this push to promote nuclear really as a hedge against the decline of fossil fuels and a way to continue drilling and, you know, and burning gas and oil.
Leona Morgan, very quickly, on this issue of renewables, also your fight right now around the Grand Canyon, you're also with the group Haul No, that's H-A-U-L.
Yes, thanks, Amy. We're fighting this uranium mine owned by Energy Fuels, which also owns the only uranium mill in the country. And so the mine would extract on Havasupai lands, and the mill is on Ute Mountain Ute lands, and the transport goes through Dene Bekea, so our lands. And this is being pushed, you know, all over the place, new uranium mining permits, new everything. And it's really not going to solve the energy crisis. There is absolutely no transition that's going to be able to power what humans can what we're consuming today. On indigenous lands, we're dealing with all kinds of different projects, such as hydrogen hubs and lithium mines. On our relatives' lands in Nevada, they're trying to protect a sacred site called Pima Hub. And then the Hualapai in Arizona, they're actually being mined by our tribe, the Navajo Nation. And so as we're fighting to protect our land and uphold our sovereignty, because the Navajo Nation has a law against transport, Haul No and others, we're also working to hold our own Navajo Nation accountable to not mine on our neighbors' sacred places. And so it's not just uranium. It's all of these transitional minerals that are going to affect some community somewhere. And we don't want that. We need to reduce our consumption in order to have not just a peaceful environment, but a safe and wholesome, how do you say, we're really concerned about our well-being. And in Diné, we say Hujon. We want a place where we can practice our culture and live in Hujon.
In these last few minutes, we're coming back to Alex de Vries in Amsterdam, founder of Digeconomist, a research company dedicated to exposing the unintended consequences of artificial intelligence and cryptocurrencies. And I'm also looking at a piece by Elizabeth Colbert in the New Yorker magazine, The Obscene Energy Demands of AI. How can the world reach net zero if it keeps inventing new ways to consume energy? And the piece begins with you, Alex. Is it true something like what it would take to fund GPChat is the fuel it would take would fuel the country of Ireland, Alex? ChatGPT, sorry.
Yeah, indeed, it could be the case. Specifically, I try to visualize what would happen if we would just turn Google into a ChatGPT, whereas a single ChatGPT interaction consumes actually just a very small amount of power, just 3 watt hours, which is, you know, something like a low lumen LED light bulb for running for 1 hour. But then again, at the scale of Google, you're talking about 9 billion of those interactions every single day. And then you will indeed have the power need of a country like Ireland just to power that. And I actually quantified that all AI-related energy consumption could quite rapidly go up to the level of a country like Argentina by the year 2027, just to power artificial intelligence alone. That doesn't include all other data centers that we use for basically cryptocurrency mining and everything else. So yeah, we see these energy demands are rapidly rising, and in a world where we have a limited renewable energy supply available, that just means that we are going to be using more of our backup energy source, which is fossil fuels.
Alex DeVries, want to thank you so much for being with us, founder of Digiconomist, speaking to us from Amsterdam. Leona Morgan, DNA organizer with Don't Nuke the Climate, as well as Hall No. And Tim Judson, executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, also part of Don't Nuke the Climate Coalition. Yes, we are broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. We want to wish a very happy birthday to Ivan Incapier. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman from Baku, Azerbaijan.
CT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Today, we're talking to Jody Bechtold, CEO of the Better Institute, a globally recognized expert in gambling addiction and a published author. Jody, great to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello to everyone.
Yeah, so I guess we can start off. How'd you get to where you are today working with gambling addiction?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. I'm a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work, and I was doing a lot in the substance use space when Pennsylvania had their first round of expanded legalized gambling. And I thought to myself, well, I'll just kind of get some training, see what it's all about. And I took the training and realized how much I loved the information. I really felt a passion and a calling for helping those affected by gambling-related harms. And I have never looked back. I just started with one certification after another, and I just kept going. So when you think about since 2007, I have been doing this very passionately and very committed. I'm just pleased to be able to help as many individuals and family members as possible. So I have a business in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, and there's six of us that also work with individuals with gambling issues and gambling-related harms and family. And, you know, we're forever busy, which is good that we're there for people. And sad that there's not many people that are starting to really be affected by the gambling-related harms. So thank you for having me on to spread the word and help educate people.
Yeah, no, for sure. We wanted to talk about gambling addiction today because I feel like it's definitely not as well covered of a problem in many spaces. And, you know, being on a college campus here at Carnegie Mellon, I don't see it mentioned very much. I'd love for our audience and myself to learn a bit more from someone with a lot of experience like you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is unfortunate. We see that across all campuses across the country. I can even tell you we see that in other countries. Gambling related harms is like so far behind where we are with acceptance about drug or alcohol issues and substance use disorders. And so it's really kind of unfortunate that we don't, you know, there's a lot more shame, stigma, and that public perception still that we fought so hard in the other addiction spaces to combat, and yet this one still seems to be very hidden.
When watching any sports broadcast today, you can notice there's this palpable increase in the amount of coverage that sports betting gets in today's media. Anytime you watch a game or a newscast, SportsCenter, they're always talking about lines and over-under and everything. And this is something that I don't fully remember seeing in broadcasts as a kid. It's definitely increased. So yeah. What are some of the reasons for that increase?
Yeah. In 2018, the Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. And what that did was it allowed each state to decide if they wanted to do sports betting, which also meant online. So unfortunately, online is kind of a big umbrella term now because so much gambling happens online, not just sports betting. But it really did allow that. And Pennsylvania was one of the first four states to say, yeah, we want it. We want to do sports betting. And in Pennsylvania and a couple other states, sports betting was legal and available right before the pandemic.